For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, two of the most intelligent cave dwellers here I'm going to meet, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell and Mr. Mark Tuttle. Gentlemen, as we speak, President Trump is in East Asia, speaking with the heads of South Korea, Japan, and those in that region. Tension is high in the area. We have North Korea, which is in somewhat of a, what we would consider a belligerent state. There's talks and rumors of war. What would justify war?
Well, Mark, I guess I'll jump in here first and say, well, yeah, this is a good occasion for us to introduce to our audience just war theory. In other words, there's a civilization have been wrestling with this with the terms or criteria by which one would decide whether or not going to war is justified. And this is going to take us pretty far back chronologically in history. And as Catholics, we have a rich intellectual tradition with some of our great thinkers who have given this much thought and laid out some structure, some criteria for us to follow.
Right. Yeah. And once again, yeah, I think this gets us back to the purpose of our show to a certain extent, that here in the Catholic Cave, what we like to do is take those current event type of issues. For instance, President Trump right now meeting in South Korea to try to resolve potential conflict with North Korea.
Without
the use of arms. Right, exactly. And I do genuinely, you know, hope and pray that that is kind of the first objective here, is to try to resolve this peacefully. But we try to take the headlines and get beneath them a little bit. Try to look at
beneath the bluster.
Exactly. But try to look at those eternal philosophical truths that really help to enlighten a situation and really help to bring light and honestly help guide us a little bit in how we as Catholics ought to think and how we as Catholics ought to react.
Yeah. So we're going to lay out some principles. And then we're going to do our best to try to apply them and see if the criteria have been met. So one of the first things I think that would be helpful in our discussion today, Mark, is let's talk about what just war theory is. And I know Wikipedia can be a dubious source for scholarship if you're engaged in academic scholarship. But I have found, though, I am a fan of Wikipedia. I find it, for just kind of general knowledge, it's a good place to start. It gives you kind of because of the editing involved and things like that, you don't want to always hang your hat on every thing that's in there in Wikipedia. But it generally is a reasonably good place to start for general information about different topics, including just war theory.
Exactly. It's a good starting point. One of the things I found about Wikipedia is if you are going to use it and use it as a, you know, even as a little bit more scholarly type of reference, it's usually very well documented. So if you...
Yeah, the footnotes at the end are really helpful.
Exactly. So if you go and you look at a point, you know, make sure to get in that practice of following up with the links below, because they're usually linked to something else online that you can
then
go back.
And primary sources, too.
And primary sources. And so as long as you follow those footnotes at the bottom, Wikipedia can be a very, very useful source for information.
I'm old enough to remember, too, Mark, the old Encyclopedia Britannica, and there were other publishers, but encyclopedias, you know, were a great source, again, for just kind of general knowledge about a whole variety of different topics and subjects. And so it would be a good place to get some of that general background.
And, you know, the Encyclopedia Britannica had some of the same issues and problems that Wikipedia does. There were biases and things that sometimes would infiltrate. Yeah, and
yeah, actual errors sometimes.
You had to be careful to try to go back and try to, you know, do a little bit additional research. So, the Encyclopedia Britannica, I found, was not as well documented and referenced, and it didn't have the extensive system of footnotes that Wikipedia does. So that's an improvement in my mind.
Oh, yeah. Wikipedia, I agree, is far better than the old encyclopedias. The breadth, the like you said, I like even the convenience of hyperlinks. Okay, so I've gotten us pretty far off our topic.
I think it's a great thing to discuss for a little bit. Of you know, when you're going out to research a philosophical topic like just war theory or something like that, where do you start? And Wikipedia is often a great starting point.
It's accessible, and then like you said, lots of springboards built into to jump into other related topics or primary sources.
Right. And since this is the Catholic Cave, another great source to as a starting point. And, mm-hmm. and yeah, I think there's some caveats around this one too. New Advent, the Catholic Encyclopedia there is a fantastic place to start to look into some of these doctrinal issues and see kind of what the Catholic Church has always said on these issues.
Yep. That's also a free online resource. I think that's another great one too. And then because so much of Catholic thought and teaching, traverses great swaths of time, centuries. The Catholic Encyclopedia New Advent, I think, is about 100 years old. I think is about how old it is. And so you might think, well, if it's 100 years old, how good it? Well, for Catholic teaching, like on the Trinity, it's not gonna change a whole lot, right, even in a century.
And even issues that have developed over time, and just war theory would be one of those, I believe. There have been some developments. The political systems in the world have changed. Mm-hmm. Even for things like that, though, going back to New Advent and trying to get kind of the timeless element from the Catholic Church that then informs how it's developed later on is incredibly useful.
Yes, correct. I couldn't agree more. And it has the benefit, too. Now is the encyclopedia there, but it has maybe all or most of the writings of the fathers of the church for free. And, of course, the indispensable Summa Theologiae from St. Thomas Aquinas.
Right, and I was just going to bring that up as yet another resource to use for looking into what the church teaches on these issues. It's a little hard sometimes to figure out chapter and verse within the Summa where to go, but when St. Thomas sat down to compile the Summa, his purpose was really to kind of create an encyclopedia of Catholic Church teaching. It was meant as a study aid, really, for students that were studying theology and philosophy. So this would give them the ability to go back and kind of get a compendium of all the answers to the debated questions and the questions that were being, you know, tossed out as part of the curriculum that they were taking.
And he must have had a lot of really smart students, because if anyone picks up the Summa, it's oh my, even though it's a summary of theology, it's quite advanced. I mean, it really, think about imagine being taught by St. Thomas Aquinas. I hope I get a chance to
you know,
meet
we should,
him.
That should be a future show at some point. We should
just on the Summa.
The medieval scholastic method, the way that those universities conducted
the rigor.
But that will have to be a...
That's a teaser for an upcoming show.
For a show preview. For another time. We're talking right now, though, about just war theory.
And so we're about to talk about it.
And St. Thomas Aquinas is actually a very good place to start, because the Summa is one of the places where the wisdom of the church has been kind of collected and dispelled down to, you know, the core values of what you should look at when you're talking about just war. And there are two parts to it, right, Tim?
Yeah, there absolutely is. The first part we're going to look at under just war theory will be the criteria, such that when all the criteria are met, going in, engaging in warfare would then be considered justified, or we might say it's ethical or moral to engage in warfare once these criteria are met.
Right. So these are all the things that you have to look at to determine that you have a just cause of war.
Well, the cause itself is actually one of the sub-criteria. The cause itself. And so we'll get into that, proportionality, et cetera. And then so that's the big of the two parts to the theory. First is, am I justified in engaging in warfare? And then the second part is, okay, now I've engaged in warfare. How do I prosecute or conduct the war? What's legitimate or justified in terms of means and ends in prosecuting the war to attain its end, which is victory, right? Victory right. over one's opponent. So the purpose of this, again, kind of referring back over to Wikipedia, the purpose of just war theory or the doctrine is to ensure that war is morally justifiable through a series of criteria, all of which, as I said, must be met for the war to be considered just. And so when we think about what those criteria are, to give you kind of a quick background, military leaders, theologians, philosophers, ethicists, members of the political establishment have all given this a lot of different consideration over time. The two probably greatest thinkers in the Catholic intellectual tradition and the two, I would say, prominent thinkers in just war theory overall are St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. So St. Augustine right. of Hippo and then St. Thomas Aquinas, each of which, in fact, Augustine, I think, is generally credited with coming up with the title or the name just war theory. And then Aquinas and other thinkers will come along and refine it. And there are still to this day, you can go to, you know, Amazon, et cetera, and find plenty of scholarship around just war theory and some agreements and disagreements on what the criteria is, how effective the framework is for actually resolving or evaluating, you know, contemporary settings that we find ourselves where there's conflict that's about to erupt.
Right. And I think just war theory itself, even independent of the church, has developed as a set of doctrines, and it's developed in a lot of ways similar to the way church doctrine does. In other words, it's grown out of these central principles. But even when you look at, you know, the writings of Clausewitz, who's a military theorist that has written a lot about just war,
yes.
you look at some of the other more contemporary, and they're not Catholics. They're still pulling from the tradition of really Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, even
yes.
to talk about it within a very secular international law type of setting.
Absolutely. That's a great point, Mark. So yeah, just war theory, as we're going to lay this out, is sort of the gold standard from, or the template from which other theories are tested or it's modified from. So this is why it's such a good thing to talk about, because it's the foundation from which other theories spring or can be modified from. But I'm going to throw out one thing here, and then we're going to have to take our first break. So the first big bucket that we talked about, first big category or leg, if you will, of just war theory is the Latin term for it is jus ad bellum, which really has to do with this theory of going to war. So what are the criteria of going to war? Well, the first one that I'll introduce, and we may need to pick up a little bit more after the break, is what's something you mentioned. Is it a just cause? So the first criteria we need to make sure is that the reason for going to war needs to be just and cannot therefore be solely for, say, recapturing things that are taken or punishing people who have done wrong. Innocent life must be in imminent danger, and intervention must be to protect life. And so that's the very first criteria. Do we have a just cause? In other words, war should be the last resort. And with that, we're going to pause. And when we come back, we're going to start unpacking more of what the criteria are for going to war.
We'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and we are talking today about just war theory. And we were just before the break talking about that first criteria of determining when it is appropriate to go to war. So just war theory really breaks down into sort of two components. On the one hand, you have to determine if you're justified to go to war, but then you also have to determine if your conduct during the war is just.
Correct. That's exactly right.
So let's talk about that first set of criteria for a little bit here, Tim. And you brought up the first component. There's about seven components here to determining whether you're justified to go to war. And the very first one is that this is a just cause, that you're not going to loot. You're not, you know, this isn't a war for oil. There were a lot of accusations when we got involved in the war at Iraq that, you know, this was to get oil, and kind of everybody intuitively realized that if that was the case, well, I'm not saying that it was, but if it was the case, then that would almost automatically make that a non-just war.
Exactly. So the way the Catechism defines a just war, or a just cause, I should say, is that it says, quote, force may be used only to correct a grave public evil. That is, say, aggression or massive violation of basic human rights of whole populations. So the criteria for a just cause is very, very high.
Right.
Now, I think during the break, you pointed out something that I did. I smuggled in last resort, which is a separate criteria,
right,
which is one of the seven.
And it's actually one of the last seven. And, you know, these go in a certain order. So you really have to start with the first one and then move from determining whether this is a just cause to determining, you know, the next part to the next part to the next part. And, you know, that last resort is one of your last criteria. So
number six on the list of seven.
You can't start with that one.
Yeah, I was eager and I tried to smuggle it in, but you caught me.
Right. So after a just cause, after we've determined that this is an attempt to stop a grave evil against a large population, whether this is a grave evil of being, you know, occupied by a foreign country, or whether this is a grave evil of some sort of genocide or something like that going on.
Correct.
What is the second criteria that we need to look at?
Comparative justice, it's called. And comparative justice means that the injustice suffered by one party is significantly greater than what might be being suffered by the other party. So you have to compare both on, say, there's two sides to the conflict. One side of the conflict must be suffering, by comparison to the other, a grave and significant amount of suffering compared to what the other. Because usually, again, in any conflict, both sides have grievances, some list of grievances. And so we have to compare those grievances. And for us to be justified to go to war and meeting the second criteria, we're going to have to meet this standard of comparative justice.
And this takes into account the consequences to a good extent of war as well. So when you're looking at the comparative justice, you know, the evil that's being perpetrated that you're trying to end, you can't go about this, and I guess this gets into the whole second realm of, you know, the way you have to conduct yourself in war, but you know, the consequences of war really can't be greater than the cause of war. So, you know, if you're trying to prevent
you're anticipating number seven, actually.
Am I?
Proportionality. Yeah.
Well, this is true, too. It's got to be proportional. But
see, it's hard to stay on the numbers.
I think there is a distinction there between between proportionality, which, you know, that's not necessarily looking at the consequences, where when you're looking at comparative justice, you're looking at, you know, the end results to a certain extent. And will the end results balance out? In other words, I'm not justified in going and invading your entire country to prevent you from, you know, doing a minor evil to the people in my country, or a relatively minor evil. You're right. That might come into proportionality, but I think more that comes into the comparative justice side of it.
Yeah. Okay. I follow where you're going. Yeah, I would agree. It's more the comparative, but about what the current state of affairs are, not so much what the end is going to be or consequences. When we're thinking about going to war, we have to look. I think we're going to look at the current state of affairs as when it comes to the comparative criteria. What's happening now, and is it the case that there's a significant imbalance, shall we say, when compare what one side's suffering versus
the other.
Well,
give us an example of a comparative justice dilemma, of a question of comparative justice that would either justify or not justify going to war.
Well, I think, for example, one might have been, so think about in World War II, for example, where Nazi Germany takes over with military force the Alsace-Lorraine part of France. It belongs to France. It's a disputed territory, but Germany breaking a treaty following the Versailles Treaty goes ahead and, in from the German point of view, reclaims territory or land. But from the French point of view, you might see that as, I think you'd be reasonable to see, the people within that region, this is where it'd be disputable, the people within that region, especially the French, who now may face oppression at the hands of the Nazis, might be justified in that they're going to, the people within there are going to suffer a disproportionate harm under Nazi occupation or being absorbed into the Reich. And so that could be an example where you would look for comparative justice.
Right. And I guess the comparative justice side of that too would be if you've got a third country that's looking at this injustice, and that third country, you know, their remedy for this is to occupy Alsace-Lorraine. You know, let's say the Swiss wanted to get involved. Highly unlikely.
Yeah. But, or the British.
The British.
Yeah.
And so, you know, their remedy to this would be to, you know, fight a war for them to occupy the Alsace-Lorraine.
Yeah.
You know,
so
Lorraine. They wouldn't be justified because that sense of proportionality wouldn't work out. Not the proportionality, that comparative justice.
Yeah, so
because whether they're ruled by Germany or whether they're ruled by Britain, it doesn't really matter to the people of Alsace-Lorraine.
Right. Yeah, and so the determination by the Allies at the time was that even though those who were aligned with, say, the Allies within that territory that was then annexed by the Third Reich, was that as bad as that is, all-out warfare would be worse,
right?
And so they didn't engage in the conflict at that moment. It wasn't until Poland.
Right. And once again, you know, I think looking at that, I would look at that as a criteria of proportionality. That, you know, all-out total war over a small territory is not proportional to.
I think under the theory, and let's jump over to proportionality. Proportionality really has to do with the level of response that you engage in to remedy, again, looking at going into warfare. So all of these are interrelated. So you could see how one builds on the other on the other. Proportionality, though, is going to speak more to the amount of force that you may use or consider using in when you're about to engage in warfare. So, for example, one side right now, one might argue that the United States is the sole superpower, and you look at our current military, the number of people that we have, the trained military that we have, the kind of weapons and ships and things of that nature, tanks and all that kind of stuff. Put it all together, compared to say what Cuba could muster in a conflict. There's a question of proportionality. It would be wrong, for example, it would be wrong for us in our response to any dispute with Cuba. We've never invaded Cuba per se, other than the failed Bay of Pigs was an attempt at that.
Right.
But generally, we've not, even though we have our Navy is far and air power is far, and we have Marines. Also, I mean, we could invade and take over Cuba. It would violate a sense of proportionality to engage in warfare in that, given using all those means at our disposal. So your response has to be in proportionality is your response. So, but it may be reasonable if Cuba does something like in the missile crisis, a sea embargo could be a proportionate response to the crisis at hand. And I think that's where proportionality can differ from the comparative justice is let's compare the situations. Proportionality begins to shape up kind of the means by which we may enter into the
questions
warfare.
Of force and, mm-hmm. And amount of response. What about let's go some of the through some of these other criteria here pretty quickly.
Next one's a kind of a no-brainer: competent authority. So in other words, you and I can't, on behalf of the United States, declare war.
Right. And, you know, in international law settings, that one becomes a little sticky sometimes, because then the question does come up, well, does the United States, as, you know, the United States, have the authority to intervene in conflicts on the other side of the globe? And then, you know, where does the authority of the United Nations begin versus the authority of a sovereign nation? So, you know, it's a no-brainer philosophically. It makes a lot of sense, and it's easy to understand. But in application, it's sometimes a little sticky.
It can be. I think in the case of the United States, it's a little more cut and dry in that we are a self-sufficient, autonomous sovereign nation, so it's easier for us to act unilaterally. I think where it really can get, to your point, really get murky these days is in third world countries where you have unstable governments that are subject to overthrows.
Right.
And coups that can last decades. And then you're kind of wondering, well, really, who is in charge of this thing we, you know, this territory we call XYZ?
Well, I'll bring up a case that's current right now where I think it is a little, you know, murky, is the question of our treaty with Iran, our nuclear treaty with Iran. This is a treaty that involved multiple nations and was overseen to a good extent by involvement by the UN. So when this treaty is broken, the question of whether the United States is the competent authority on our own to act unilaterally without these other countries that are signees of this treaty, that is an active question of competent authority.
I think that's a legitimate question. I'll throw out one more before we have to take our next break, which is something you were alluding to also, Mark, which is right intention. So in other words, when taking, say, the first Gulf War, that was in generally response to the Iraqi aggression over the Kuwaiti nation and occupying Kuwait, that our response, our right intention would be to liberate the people of Kuwait versus seizing oil fields for our own consumption.
Right.
As a form of kind of theft.
Right.
And so you have to have the right intentions going into things. So with that, we're going to pause, and Kent's looking over here saying, hey, we got to take another break. You're listening to The Catholic Cave, and we're talking about just war theory.
At Catholic Radio, we love to hear from you. Call us anytime. Just recently, we found this message on our voicemail.
I'm a non-Catholic that listens to your Catholic radio station, and I just wanted to thank you guys. I listen to Catholic Answers and Al Cresta sometimes, and I think her name's Teresa Tommy. I listen to her and another show or two. I appreciate it.
Call us at 317-870-8400 and let us know what you're thinking.
I just called to say, even though I'm not a Catholic, I listen to your station.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
If it wasn't for you all, I don't know what I would do.
Catholic Radio Indy.
What an absolute blessing you are.
Welcome back once again to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blandford, and we are talking about just war. We were going through all of the criteria and conditions and questions that need to be asked to determine whether a country is justified to go to war to begin with. And so we'll kind of finish up this with the last couple of points, and then we'll move on to the prosecution of the war. What are you justified to do, and what kinds of things are you not justified to do in the course of war that would suddenly make your conduct or the war itself unjust? So we had just gone through some of the first criteria of just war, and that is that you have to have a just cause, that you have to have a
comparative justice.
There's comparative justice involved, that you are a competent authority, And then we had just talked about right intent, that, that, you know, your intention for going to war is to undo this wrong that has been done, not some sort of ulterior motive for the gain of your
nation. To address the just cause should be your intention.
Exactly. But the last two here have to do, I think, less with kind of the cause, but really more with how the situation is going to be rectified.
This is where we kind of, this is where we look at, we talked about last resort. So in other words, we've already, and this is a teaching of Holy Mother Church, is peace is to be sought, you know, vigorously, thoroughly. And so using nonviolent means to bring about, short of warfare, to bring about the ends to rectify whatever injustice is happening should be done first. So this is diplomacy, sanctions, things of that nature, sometimes isolating countries or bad actors. These are all things that are at the disposal of United States, other countries, the United Nations can do that, can attempt to do that. But when all that fails, then one would then look at this criteria, last resort. In other words, we've all these other methods we've tried, the ones that were available to us, they failed to bring about the end that we're looking for. And so therefore, the warfare is what's left, the use of violence to coerce one's enemies.
And finally, if you've gone through all of those, your cause is just, there's some sort of, the justice is there. You weigh it out. You're using proportionate means. This is the last resort. You've gone through every other means possible. It still may not be the case that you're justified to going to war if you're not capable of succeeding.
Correct.
And so that right. So that probability of success is actually,
you got to be able to have some reasonable hope of winning.
Right, exactly. So you're not justified just to take up arms against a great behemoth, nation that is causing giant evils within the world. If you really, you're taking up arms isn't going to really make a lick of difference.
Correct. Yeah. So that would be the last one that we wanted to talk about. So there were seven. This jus ad bellum about going to war. They are. Just to recap, because then we want to move into prosecuting. It first is it a just cause? Second, comparative justice. Third, competent authority. Fourth, right intention. Fifth, probability of success. Sixth, last resort. Seven, proportionality. So once we've met all those criteria,
and that's a pretty high bar.
It's a very, very high bar, and rightfully so, because warfare has always been understood as unleashing terrible evils upon the world, upon the combat zones, and bringing about great suffering to untold innocents. And so in ways that you just can't, you just humanity's been unable to, even very competent military and political experts have cannot see, fully see where war will lead you ultimately. It's wildly unpredictable once you engage in it. So at the beginning, so if you're sitting in 1939 and with the invasion of Poland in September, you can't really see what the next 5-6 years are really going to hold and how much devastation and killing there really is going to be.
Right. You know, you think about some of the consequences and you look at literature and the stories of World War II, and you've got stories of English children, you know, having to leave London to go to the countryside, and the hardships and everything involved with that for the children, which, I mean, there were obviously greater hardships involved with World War II. But that initial, you know, attempt to repel the Germans from invading Poland, that was completely unforeseen. I mean, right. I don't think anybody was able to see that was going to be one of the consequences.
I don't think anyone sees, like, the invasion of Russia or the Soviet Union by Nazi Germany. I mean, there's all kinds of horrible things that happen, which is why it's a last resort, because history has shown and that all these forces can get unleashed.
And this leads us into the discussion of the prosecution of the war, how people ought to conduct themselves in some ways to try to mitigate these evils and unforeseen, horrible things that happen during war.
Correct. So this is the second part, if you will, of just war theory. The Latin is jus in bello, which is speaking to justice as in the prosecution or the carrying out of warfare. There's five of these. The first is called distinction. Distinction is in prosecuting a war, you need to make a reasonable distinction between combatants and non-combatants. In other words, you can't just lump, if you're at war against a particular nation, you just can't lump everybody into a single category and destroy them all. You have to make a distinction between combatants and non-combatants. Now, this can become very difficult.
I was going to say, in modern industrialized world, that sometimes becomes very difficult because you've got all of the means of supporting an army that in a lot of ways involves the entire nation.
Well, there's that. I also think a way to think about it in a kind of a traditional sense is a way to make an easier distinction would be those who wear a uniform and those who don't. So a conflict between, say, the United States and, say, Russia is likely to involve combatants wearing uniforms. Now, where it becomes very difficult, and this is something Israel faces quite a bit, a lot of the Islamic terrorist groups do not wear uniforms. And so they blend in on purpose to look like civilians. And that's where it can become very difficult but you have to make the attempt,
right,
is the point. You have to try to differentiate. So what's particularly wicked or evil is for an enemy combatant to present as a civilian, engage in combat whilst hiding in a hospital.
Right, exactly, because that's automatically going to draw in innocent civilians. I think that
correct. It's a way to obscure the distinction.
And I would argue, the distinction of uniforms in the modern setting, I mean, even during World War II, even during conflicts that are a little more cut and dry than some of the ones that seem to be going on now, the uniform distinction becomes blurry and difficult to see. So I think that the distinction of innocent civilians in some ways makes it a little bit, because
I just say uniforms because it's easy to picture.
Well,
if you didn't wear a uniform, if you were a combatant, if you're a member of the military and you were not in uniform, and you were captured, you were considered a spy and you were executed.
Right.
And so you were treated differently because, again, it's a kind of violation of this principle of distinction when you're deliberately disguising yourself, hiding the fact that you're actually a combatant and presenting yourself as a non-combatant.
Right.
And that's a kind of violation. So that's why it's so problematic.
Right. But where the, like I said, where the uniform thing breaks down is when you're looking at support of the war machine, when you're looking at large industrialized. So, for instance, the United States bombed ball bearing plants. We bombed chemical plants. We bombed a lot of the support system for the German war machine. And those people weren't wearing uniforms when they were working in those plants.
Correct.
But they were still supporting the army. And so, therefore, they weren't exactly innocent civilians. On the other hand, if we had bombed shopping malls, which I think we kind of, in some ways, we may have fallen into that a little bit. But that's easy to
condemn.
The
firebombing of Dresden probably is one of
those types of instances are easy to condemn.
Or the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki bring up those questions of, how did we violate this principle of distinction?
Right. And that brings us to kind of the second point in conducting the war. And once again, we get back to the proportionality.
Correct. Now we're engaged in warfare. So proportionality is going to have us look at, using having a reasonable use of force for what the situation calls for. So to step out of warfare setting, say as a small way to bring the principle to light would be, let's say you're at home, Mark, with your family, and I'm an intruder. I break into your house. You have a pistol and you know how to use it and it's accessible. So you pull out your pistol and you point it at me and you shout at me and tell me to stop what I'm doing and tried to, so that you can call the police and have me arrested. Well, that would be an appropriate or proportionate response, because you're using a threat of force to stop me from doing harm to you and your family. What wouldn't be okay would be for me then to put my hands up after you've told me to stop at gunpoint, and then once I have my hands up and I'm completely at your mercy, you give me a headshot, right?
Right.
And kill me on purpose, you know, even though the threat has been contained. You violated proportionality. You've used too much force for what the situation would prudently mandate. And this is true in warfare. So it would be wrong. So you think about, say, when the United States invaded Grenada. Well, when we invaded Grenada, to right a wrong, it would have been wrong. We sent in Marines and easily toppled the government there to restore law and order. That's what that was about. Generally understood what that's about. Well, it would have been wrong to go in with, say, tactical nuclear weapons on the island of Grenada first, you know,
right?
to subdue the military. Yeah, they had
or
very
even
little
to
military.
Shell it, you know, right. You could shell the island with a battleship.
Yeah, for 6 months. Yeah, yeah. Put in a blockade for 12 months to starve them out, and then launch some sort of 6 months of a constant barrage from battleships, and then we send in troops. You know, it was just, you know, it's wildly outrageous.
Yeah,
right?
way over the top. Correct. Response to the situation. Well, let's come back here.
We got three more to cover.
Right. So we'll come back. We'll cover those last three here, and then we'll wrap up our discussion on just war right after the break.
And you're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell. Still in the cave, Mark Tuttle and Kent Blanford. We have been talking about just war theory. First part of the show, we're in the last segment of the show. So what we've covered so far is, with just war theory, we've looked at and completed the first major category within just war theory, which is, what are the criteria, the seven criteria that must be met in order for a nation to be considered justified in engaging in warfare? Now what we've done is we've moved into the sort of second big category, jus in bello, which is really about, what does justice look like in prosecuting, or once one's engaged in warfare, what's licit or legal or principles that we would use to say that we're prosecuting the war in a just fashion. We've covered two already, Mark. The first was distinction, which is making this, we need to differentiate between combatants and non-combatants. We've also looked at proportionality, which is having a reasonable size response for the occasion, not too little or too much.
Not bringing a tank to a knife fight.
Correct. Exactly. And now we have three more to cover, though. The next one is we're going to look at military necessity. So in other words, when the generals are making plans, let's say, they should be, their strategy should be aiming at targets of military necessity, not say personal gain.
Right. And you know, I think there's some other criteria too within that when you look back at history. You know, I think one of the questionable ones that I think might be a case study that we can look at and get an idea is General Sherman's march, you know, during the Civil War, where he marched into the South, and rather than engaging the enemy army all the way through, he burnt the farms. He, did as much as he could to kind of go out of his way to sort of terrorize the public. And so he had
to
break their will to fight. And so there's an argument as to whether that fits the criteria of military necessity or not.
I'll tell you another example, and this is from fiction, but one of my favorite movies of all times is a Clint Eastwood one called Kelly's Heroes. And this was made, I think, in the late 60s. all-star cast of all kinds of people have cameos in there. Donald Sutherland, Don Rickles, some of you may remember him. And the whole point of it is that Clint Eastwood as Sergeant Kelly is going to lead a group of GIs behind. They've had it with the war, and they've decided, they've heard that there's a bank, a German bank behind enemy lines, full of gold. So they decided, hey, I got to get something out of this for me. So they lead an unauthorized incursion behind enemy lines to go steal this gold out of this German bank, and it is a fantastic movie. It's funny. It's got it's got action in it. It's got some suspense. And again, all-star cast. But this would be a violation of military necessity.
We can see why this was an unauthorized excursion.
Right. So military necessity is a part of it. The next, we got two more to go. The next one is something I think we're all very familiar with, which is the fair treatment of prisoners. So sometimes you'll hear it referred to as the Geneva Convention, which really outlined what fair treatment looks like. And when there's in our contemporary setting, this issue comes up frequently with Guantanamo Bay.
Right. And in interrogation, I think, is where the questionable conduct comes in.
Yeah. Is it harsh interrogation techniques like waterboarding? Does that qualify in that camp? Or others might categorize it as, no, that's torture. But the fair treatment of prisoners is one of the principles we have to look at.
And obviously we can see why this is an important component of, you know, justly prosecuting war, because that can escalate very quickly between how, you know, different sides of the war are treating each other's prisoners.
Correct. Absolutely. And then, and that's also, I would say historically, that's also where the Catholic Church has also been very vocal. And this is where organizations like the Red Cross come into play and things like that, about helping those who have been, captured in our POWs, receive the right level of, assistance, that they have adequate food, shelter, housing, those sorts of things. And then let's get to the last one. So this is the fifth. And this one, the Latin phrase is malum in se, which means by no means.
Yeah,
so
don't go there.
Right, exactly.
just don't go there. Right.
And these are, so this is, this criteria speaks to the fact that there are certain tools of destruction that are off limits in warfare, that are never justified, and which tools those are can be debated. But generally biological weaponized biological things like weaponizing anthrax would be considered intrinsically evil and off limits. World War I saw the use of extensive chemical warfare in the terms of poison gas. That's considered. You have Assad's been accused of that in Syria, and that certainly has drawn moral outrage. So chemical and biological, but also Holy Mother Church often will speak to. There's a long tradition of speaking over the last 50 plus years about what. Nuclear weapons.
Right. Yeah. I think there have been a lot of, letters from bishops, letters from national councils of bishops, really addressing nuclear weapons and trying to make the case. And it's a matter of debate as to how successful they've been at making this case, that nuclear weapons themselves fall into that malum in se category of, you know, this is just totally prohibited and should never be used.
Right.
Never justified. And I think that brings us into another interesting discussion of, you know, all of these criteria that we're looking at and the decision to go to war. This is a prudential decision. So this is a type of decision, and it's a prudential decision for competent authorities, for those who are qualified to make these decisions. So there's an interesting, there's some roles that the laity play as leaders of these countries. And, you know, we live in a republic where, you know, in theory, we are all leaders of our country, versus the role that the church plays as dispenser of doctrine and defender of eternal
faith and morals.
Of faith and morals and eternal mm-hmm. truths. Exactly. And so, you know, those lines can get a little blurry sometimes too.
Well, this is why the great thinkers the Saint Augustine, Saint Thomas Aquinas, devoted much time and wrote about just war theory because they recognized that Holy Mother Church has an indispensable role to play in terms of developing adequate principles and then promoting those principles as a way of what shedding light or informing the laity on how best to think about these things, something as important as warfare.
Right. And, you know, I think there's a prerogative within there with the church has of really always urging peace, always pushing for peace.
Yes.
And always, you know, even laying out these criteria that, yes, sometimes it is justified to go to war, but still at the same time, always urging peace.
Yeah. So you might be justified in going, a nation may satisfy all the criteria and then engage in war and prosecute the war justly. But the goal is ultimately what? To restore peace. And peace ought to be, I think it's helpful too, not to define peace the way, say, Thomas Aquinas would, which is peace is not defined as simply nonviolence or simply a cessation of violence. That's not peace at all. Peace is, I think it's in the pastoral constitution of the Second Vatican Council. It speaks it pretty eloquently. And I think, off the top of my head, I would say it's something like this. Peace is the fruit of justice. Justice is brought about through the tranquility of order. So when you have the tranquility of order, you're going to achieve justice. When you have justice in society and justice across nations, then you won't have the kind of violations of human rights that fuel warfare.
Right. So one of the uses of these criteria isn't just for determining whether currently it is justified to go to war, but also in the looking back in history and looking back at conflicts and things that have arisen in history, it is often useful to use these criteria to look and kind of figure out who was justified, who wasn't justified, which wars were good wars and which wars were bad wars, so to speak.
Well, I think the one that's has come up again recently, and because of the anniversaries, are really the bombing, the use of the only time atomic weapons have been used in human history was by the United States against Imperial Japan. And I think all of our listeners are familiar, you know, that with that historical event. But what theologians and philosophers are wrestling with, looking back, and that in and of itself has caveats that go along with it. But really trying to, you know, was it justified? And I think this is a good exercise for us to go through and a good controversy for us to talk through with each other, because it has ramifications for the current setting. When you look at, say, what's, again, how we started the show, when you look at North Korea versus the United States, we're very much in a heated exchange right now that doesn't involve warfare yet or the direct military action yet, but it may. And it's good for us to be talking about just war theory, to be informed so that what I like to tell my students is everyone has an opinion, right? We all have opinions. But I tell them, you know, opinions are just not very valuable, and I'm not very interested in opinions. What I am interested in is your informed opinion. So in other words, once you've looked into an issue, once you've gathered some facts, some evidence, arguments, then you've got an opinion that's worth really sharing with others, and I'm very, very interested in informed opinions.
Right, and so these criteria of just war that we've gone through, the seven principles that determine whether you are justified in going to war, the six principles that kind of determine whether you're justified in conducting the war the way that you're conducting them, these are tools that are laid out there for people to be able to inform their opinions and move in the realm, not only from informed opinion, but ultimately, hopefully, towards truth.
Yeah, and it's a conceptual framework that can hopefully move us past just purely emotional responses.
And gentlemen, that is all the time we have for this week's Catholic Cave. We'll be back next week on the Catholic Cave.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.